Lecture 9, Conquering Language. What did the Normans do to English?
Hello, and welcome to the Norman Conquest. In this lecture, Lecture 9, I'm going to talk about the impact of the Norman Conquest on the English language. I'll spend a fair amount of time on words, new vocabulary terms that came in from Norman and then later from Central French into the English language. But I'll also be talking about some changes in the patterns of literature and poetry, changes in the landscape of England, changes in architecture, and also ways in which we today can still see the legacy of the Norman Conquest in the sounds and words of our own living language. Now, in looking at the Norman Conquest, we need to think about several things that are at work. First, we need to ask ourselves some general questions, not just about which words were borrowed, but about why words are borrowed. Why is it, not just during this period, but during all periods of a language's history, are words borrowed? Why do speakers of a language decide or come to recognize that certain vocabulary terms will no longer suffice? I think we can come up with two broad general reasons why words enter a language. I think first we might like to say that words are borrowed if the donor language is of greater prestige in the field of borrowed words. In other words, the language that you're borrowing from has a set of institutions which are of greater prestige or social import than the culture of the borrowing language. So, for example, in the case of the Norman Conquest and in the case of the history of English, when we're looking at terms for government, political organization, educated discourse and high culture, and the church, we're looking at a confluence, not just of languages, but of social ranks and classes. And words tended to be borrowed in those areas because they came to be dominated by French-speaking Normans. But secondly, we could argue that words are borrowed if there is a vacant slot for the word in the receiving language. In other words, if there is no native word for a concept or a thing, and the new language community brings that concept or thing in. Now, I've talked in earlier lectures about the way in which Old English and the Germanic languages borrow words, but also how they seemed to have resisted borrowing words. In Old English, in the poetry of Cædmon, but also in the Germanic languages, for example, in modern Icelandic, which I've talked a little bit about, there seems to have been a tendency to coin words out of the base vocabulary, out of the core lexis, as it were, of the language, rather than borrow new words in. So in the case of Icelandic, an extreme case of a linguistic culture that resists loan words, borrowed words, a word of technical meaning like hysterical, which is borrowed into virtually every European modern language from psychoanalytic theory, becomes a calque. It's, as it were, translated from its root into a word mothersick or mothersickness, playing on the idea of the feminine in the hysteric. And this is a kind of pattern that we can see in certain kinds of languages. So the larger question, it seems to me, is not simply how do words come in, which words come in, but rather what is there about a fundamental shift in English that transforms it from a language that seems to resist borrowing to a language that welcomes it. One of the characteristic features of English during the period after the Norman Conquest, during the Renaissance in the 16th and 17th centuries, and during our own time, is what I would call its voracity for words. English is omnivorous. It loves new words. It brings them in from other languages. Some speakers resist this, and we will see throughout this course how certain speakers are afraid or resentful or resistant to the new words that come in, while other speakers or writers will revel in the strange and the exotic quality of loan words. Now, during this period, new words come in very, very quickly, and they come in a variety of ways. But before I look at some of these words, I just want to contextualize the effects of these words briefly. What happens when you bring new words into a language? One thing that happens is you change the sound and stress patterns of the language. Now, many Old English words, especially words that pass into our own language, are monosyllabic. They tend to have one syllable. Or even words that are polysyllabic tend to be compounds in Old English. Now, by contrast, words in the Romance languages, that is, the languages that descended from Latin, those words tend to be polysyllabic. They tend to be words of many syllables. Furthermore, they tend to be words of variable stress. In Old English, as in most of the modern Germanic languages, stress on a word is always on the root syllable. That is, you place stress on the main part of the word, and if there's a suffix or a prefix, you do not stress it. Come, become. Not come, become. Stand, withstand. In Old English. In the Romance languages, however, stress was variable. That is, depending on the suffixes or prefixes, or the place of the word in a sentence or an utterance, the stress on the word could vary. Now, when these kinds of words enter into English, they permanently affect the stress pattern, the sound, the feel of the English language. So, just a couple of examples. Record, record. Same word, two patterns of stress. Record is a noun. Record is a verb. Canon. Stress on the first syllable. Canonization. Stress on the penultimate syllable, the next to last syllable. This variable word stress, of which I've just given this couple of examples, is a key feature of the Romance languages, and it affects the sound pattern of English. Another importation that affects the sound pattern and stress structure of English is in poetry. I closed my previous lecture with a quotation from the beginning of The Owl and the Nightingale. This poem, written in early Middle English, probably at the close of the 12th century, and then written down in manuscripts at the beginning of the 13th century, is a poem which uses primarily an Old English vocabulary, but it presses it into the service of a newer continental French pattern of verse making. Let me go back to that poem and read a little more. Ich was in ona sumradala, in ona sude digla hala, e herdich hold a greta tala, an ulla and ona nichtingala. I was in a summery dale, in a secret little nook, and I heard there held a great tale, a debate, a discussion between an owl and a nightingale. Every word is Old English. But what happens in the next line? That plait was stiff and stark and strong. That plait, that pleading, that discussion. Now, that's a new word. That is a word from the Norman French vocabulary. But in that line of poetry, a line of 8 syllables, listen to it, a Norman French word of legal terminology, plate. What was it? It was stiff and stark and strong. Now that's alliterative poetry. That's Old English. In this line, you can see brought together the new and the old, the continental and the English, the French and the Anglo-Saxon. Alliterative poetry, I like to think at this line, alliterative poetry is almost struggling to get out of a French octosyllabic line. It's almost as if the Anglo-Saxon has been shoehorned into the Norman in this moment. This is a kind of crystallization, I think, of the problem that I'm talking about. The way in which a language in contact with another language changes not just by adding words, but by changing, perhaps in anxious and sometimes ambiguous ways, its very sound, its texture, its literary structure. Now, when we turn to the words themselves, we can see that there are many special kinds of words that the Normans brought into the English language. First, they brought a whole set of religious terms because the Normans very quickly took over the church. The last Anglo-Saxon-born bishop died in 1095, almost 30 years after the Norman conquest. So, a full generation or so after the conquest, what you see conquered is, first and foremost, primarily, the church. And so words like prophet, saint, Baptist, miracle, paradise, sacrament, words like that are words from a religious vocabulary that come into English through new Norman ecclesiasts, priests, bishops, writers, homilists, and sermon makers. The Normans, too, as controllers of social and political institutions, also brought a whole set of words from these areas. Prince, dame, master, court, rent, poor, rich, prison, crown, purple, prove. This seems a relatively random list, but as I read it out aloud, you can hear a history of conquest. What does it mean now to have not an evil, an old English aristocrat, but a prince? What does it mean now not to have a Chladia, a lady, but a dama, a dame? What does it mean to have someone who is a master or a court? What does the master and the court do? They charge rent. What is the man who charges rent? He becomes rich. What about the person who is charged the rent? He becomes poor. What happens if you don't pay the rent? You're put in a prison. Who really gets the rent? The crown. What does the crown wear? Purple. What is the job of the crown? To prove. And so on. In this seemingly random list is a story of conquest and control. The Normans also were great builders. And terms of architecture are in many ways Norman terms. And it seems to me that the most illustrative of these terms is the word castle. I want to say a few words about castles. The Anglo-Saxons did not build monumentally in dressed stone. What does that mean? What that means is that when the Anglo-Saxons built big buildings, they did not build them out of stone that had been quarried and cut into blocks, dressed stone. Rather, the Anglo-Saxons built out of wood, or they built out of flint cobble, that is, out of large stones that would be placed together with mortar. In fact, the Old English verb to build is timbrion, which is literally to timber. So there in the verb is the structure. The Normans, however, built monumentally in dressed stone. And the Normans, when they arrived, built castles. The word castle comes from a Latin word meaning an enclosed or fortified encampment of a special kind. And as soon as the Normans arrived, they started building these castles. Now let's go back to that text I was talking about earlier, the Peterborough Chronicle. The Peterborough Chronicle has an entry in the year 1087 for the death of William the Conqueror, died the previous year. And in the middle of this entry is a poem that someone has written on the death of William the Conqueror. And the poem begins, it's a eulogy, but it's also a critique. The poem begins with the line, Castellus haelet virtian. He had castles built. I think it's terribly significant that in this late Old English bit of history, we have a poem on the death of William the Conqueror that begins, that has its very first word, castles. It's a loan word, but it's also a loan concept. It's a new thing. The word signals the imposition of a foreign architectural structure on a native English landscape. And similarly, by beginning the poem in this way, the poet signals the imposition of the Norman lexicon into the English language. Castellus helet virtian, and armamen suiva suentian. Now that's the first couplet of this poem. But listen to that. This is a poem that's written in about 1087. At least it's dated as 1087. Now, we're talking about a poem a century before The Owl and the Nightingale, which I just read to you. But what did I just give you? Castellus helet virtian and armamen suiva suentian. I've just given you a couplet. And it sort of, but not quite, rhymes. This poem works through rhymed couplets. Or let me put it more precisely. It works through the attempt at rhymed couplets. I believe that what I've just given you is the first attempt in the English language to write verse in rhymed couplets. And I think it's significant that whoever wrote it about a Norman king. What's going on in this poem at the level of language is the sense again of how the Norman French imposes itself on the English, not just verbally, but metrically, prosodically, literarily, architecturally, aesthetically. It's a nice little bit of irony to mime, as it were, the sound of Norman poetry in the eulogy for the Norman king. Now, Norman French was not, in fact, the only venue for French words coming into the English language. About two centuries after the Norman conquest, another wave of French borrowing comes in. And this is from Central French. Now, let me sort of clarify what I'm talking about here. The Normans are, to use perhaps a more modern term ethnically, a Germanic people. In fact, their name, Normans, really just means Northmen. They descend from a group of Germanic, Viking, or Scandinavian raiders who settled in the coast of Normandy, probably in the 10th century, and assimilated themselves into a French-speaking community, but they are really, in many ways, more like the English than they are like the French. Norman French has many sounds that are part of the older Germanic sound system. Norman French sounds different from Central French. Let me give you some examples. Norman French words that begin with a k sound correspond to Central French words that begin with a sh sound. And these are indicated by writing the word with a c or with a ch. A Norman Frenchman would build a castle. A Central Frenchman would build a chateau. A Norman Frenchman might keep cattle. A Central French might keep chattel. Remember, cattle and chattel. A Norman French would wear, a Frenchman or Frenchwoman might wear a cap. But someone from Central France would wear a chapeau. These words survive in modern English. I'm going through this in detail because I want you to see how the words are still in the language, how they come from two regional dialect variants of the same language, and how they enter, as it were, in layers, one successively after the other. Here's another good one. Norman French words that were pronounced with a W, wa, in Central French would have been pronounced with a G. In English, this is the difference between writing a word with a W and writing a word with the initial G-U. In Norman French, a warden became in Central French a guardian. If you were wily as a Norman, you had guile as a Central Frenchman. If you waged war as a Norman, you would wage a guerre as a Central Frenchman. William the Conqueror is William the Conqueror because he's a Norman. He is not Guillaume. This is very significant, it seems to me. The Normans, as a Germanic people, still have the patterns of pronunciation of the Germanic languages. How can we see the legacy of Norman and Central French vocabulary in our own languages? Spot the loan word. Just think for a minute. Any word that's spelled with an E-I, an E-Y, or an O-Y is a French word. Obey, air, fair, quaint, these are French words. O-I, boy, joy, toy, royal, exploit, these are French words. Any word that ends in I-O-N or I-U-N or T-I-O or T-I-O-N, these are loan words. Nouns ending in words like ment, amend, ment, these are French words. Anything that ends in ence or ence is a loan word. Anything that ends in ur is a loan word, or us, or os, O-U-S. Now, here's a good one. How do you know how to spell certain words? When I teach English, I always encounter spelling problems that I can explain to my students through the history of the English language. In Central and Norman French, any word that ended in a U-S was a noun. And this descends from the old Latin noun endings. But any word that ended in O-U-S was an adjective. So how do you know whether you have a callus or whether somebody is callous? Callus, C-A-L-L-U-S, is the noun. Callous, C-A-L-L-O-S, O-U-S, is the adjective. Now, a problem in spelling is explainable historically. Let's think also of some legacies of conquest in everyday speech. I've mentioned issues of architecture, and I've mentioned issues of culture. Now, let's think about food. We think intuitively of the French as great cooks. We say that because we have as our prestige language of cuisine, well, just the word itself. Our prestige language of cuisine is, of course, French. French becomes the language of high culture, of courtiership, just the word courtiership, of chivalry. What is chivalry? What is etymologically, all chivalry is the pattern of behavior of someone who rides a cheval. And a cheval is a horse. Chivalry, etymologically, is just good horsemanship, in some sense. But it refers to the class of horse-riding aristocrats or soldiers. Now, as early as the early 19th century, Sir Walter Scott imagined the world of the Norman conquest in his historical novels. And in Ivanhoe, I think it is, he comes up with an interesting set of associations that I think are still useful in an almost intuitive way for understanding the relationships between French and English as miming social relationships between Anglo-Saxons and Normans. Let's think of it this way. You have a veneer of Norman-French control over, as it were, the stock of Anglo-Saxon Old English-speaking landscape. And your Anglo-Saxon peasant, or esne, servant, peasant figure, would be working on the land. And your Anglo-Saxon would raise an animal, like a sow. But by the time the sow was killed, butchered, and the meat came to the French-speaking person's table, it became pork. The cow, coo in Old English, became beef. Beef. The calf, Old English, became bow, veal. The lamb became mouton, mutton. And the deer, which is really just the Old English word for any kind of wild animal, but can apply to deer in particular, became venison. Now, in French, you do not really have this distinction. That is, there is no distinction verbally between the animal and the meat that comes from the animal. But in English, we make that distinction. We do not say we're having cow for dinner. We do, right? We don't say, you know, we're having calf for dinner. In fact, what we do so would be to make dinner horribly unappetizing. But what we do say is we're having pork or beef or veal. In other words, the prestige language of Norman French still textures our notions of what constitutes the appetizing. Now, I've been talking as if Norman French infiltrated English, and that over a period of time, English seems to have absorbed or been absorbed by the French. But the important thing to stress in closing this lecture, and a way of bridging into my subsequent lectures on Chaucer's English and on later medieval attitudes towards the English language, is to recognize that for a long period of time, let's say from about the end of the 12th century to the beginning of the 15th century, England is a trilingual culture. English, French, and Latin. Now, this is not to say that every English person spoke three languages, but what it is to say is that these three languages, in varying combinations, are the languages of culture, experience, and life. England is a trilingual culture, and in closing this lecture, I want to give a little example of how that works. I've talked about English poetry. I've talked about the way in which English poetry can very often crystallize linguistic and social conflict. At the beginning of the 13th century, a scribe somewhere in central England wrote down a collection of English lyrics. These lyrics came to be part of a medieval manuscript. The medieval manuscript during the Renaissance was owned by Lord Robert Harley. When this manuscript was bequeathed to the British Museum as part of Harley's collection, it became known as the Harley Lyrics. If you were to read this lyric or any other in a book, you'd want to look for the Harley Lyrics. And one of these Harley lyrics is, in fact, not in English, but it's in English, French, and Latin. This is a little poem about love, and it ends with this quatrain. Scripsi hec carmina in tabulis. Mon hôtel est mauvais, la vie de Paris. May isujun amor so well me is, yet a dare for love of her dwell it is. What did I just read? I read four lines. The first one is in Latin. I've written this poem on tablets. I've written it in my little notebook. And then, my dwelling place is in the middle of the city of Paris. That second line was in French. And then lines three and four were in English. May I not sing anymore? Because things are good with me. And yet, if I die for love of her, well, it's a terrible thing. Latin, French, English. Scripsi hec carmina in tabulis. Latin, the language of writing, the language of the church, the language of scholarship. Mon hôtel est ma vie, la vie de Paris. My place and my life is in the middle of the city of Paris. Well, if you were an Englishman, where did you go to study? You went to Paris. But when you gave voice to your inner feelings and expressions, when you talked about love, loss, and desire, you said it in English. Trilingual culture, Latin, French, and English. When we look at Chaucer's language, in my next lecture, we're going to see how Latin, French, and English become now not just the alternating languages of poetry, but they become the synthesized language of expression. Thank you.